This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Friday, September 8th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. On Tuesday, Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced that the Trump administration was ending the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. President Obama created DACA in June 2012 to shield minors from deportation. It currently protects over 800,000 immigrants who were brought to the U.S. as children. In Sessions' public statement, he argued that DACA was unconstitutional and undermined the interests of the American people.
The effect of this unilateral executive amnesty, among other things, contributed to a surge of minors at the southern border that yielded terrible humanitarian consequences. It also denied jobs to hundreds of thousands of Americans by allowing those same illegal aliens to take those jobs. We inherited from our founders and have advanced an unsurpassed legal heritage, which is the foundation of our freedom, our safety, and our prosperity.
Jelani Cobb joins me to discuss the history of anti-immigration policies in the U.S. and how to assess the period we're living through now. Jelani, welcome.
Thank you.
This decision came after the white supremacist violence in Charlottesville and Trump's pardon of Joe Arpaio, the former Arizona sheriff infamous for rounding up and detaining Latinos he suspected of being here illegally. You're an American historian, and so I'm interested in hearing you talk a little bit about previous periods of virulent xenophobia and racism in this country.
Sure. When you think about it, in those three events that you mentioned, it seems that you can get the kind of broad outlines of where this administration is on these matters of race, and specifically race as it relates to immigration. And I would add one other thing in there, which is the announcement of their support for the RAISE Act, which is intended to cut authorized immigration by 50%. When you look at all those things together, they struck me as being a kind of throwback to an earlier period in American history. At the beginning of the 20th century, where there was a great deal of concern about subversives and radicals who were in the country, be they anarchists or Bolsheviks, and those concerns about national security neatly dovetailed with biases that happened to be against particular ethnic groups. It was Catholics and Jews.
And even further back than that, in the 19th century, we had the Know Nothing Party,
which was devoted
to the idea of keeping out Irish Catholics mostly. And then, of course, the birth of the KKK. Those patterns are very obvious, too.
It's also interesting, too, because we had those two swells of anti-Catholic sentiment, both in the 19th century and then reemerging virulently in the 20th century. So kind of, we had those two bites of the apple and then, of course, kind of lulls of periods where it remains an element of American society, but not maybe a defining element, so much so that even 1960, famously, of course, John F. Kennedy had to address it in his presidential campaign, his Catholicism. So I think we can find these kinds of connections, but, you know, the beginning of the 20th century, we find it like really strong resemblance to the politics and the social anxieties that we're seeing now. And of course, those ideas found expression in the 1924 Immigration Restriction Act, which very famously was calibrated to reduce the number of people who were coming from Southern and Eastern Europe, favoring people who would come from Western Europe, and a kind of racial engineering was implicit.
I wonder whether you see the same kinds of underlying causes. Does this kind of thing come about when we've emerged from a relatively progressive era and there's a reaction against it?
Both instances emerge from a previous context of, you know, significant immigration and a kind of progressive idea and an accepting ideal of who we want to allow into the country. And so in the 1880s, 1890s, driven by industrialization and urbanization and this really significant need for labor, the United States has a much more open policy in terms of admission of immigrants. And then by the 20th century, we start seeing a real pushback and a real backlash against that. And so I think the same thing is now, although we have maybe a little bit of a longer lead time, because, you know, the real target, I think, of this administration is repealing the world that was created by the 1965 Immigration Act, the Hart-Sellers Act, which, of course, famously liberalized the way American immigration works. We got rid of ethnic quotas and allowed a much more broad palette of immigrants to come into the country.
Obama is alarmed. On Wednesday, he said in a Facebook post objecting to this policy, this is about who we are as a people and who we want to be. And yet, you could also see the rise of Donald Trump. In fact, Trump has said this as a reaction to the Obama presidency.
Sure. He's not only the first black president, but he is the son of someone who was allowed to come to the country for education. That's not a perspective that very many Americans have. And so I think that this goes to the core of not only Obama's presidency, but the changes in American society that made Obama's presidency possible.
Not so long ago, the two parties weren't all that far apart on immigration. The original DREAM Act was written in 2001 by Democratic Senator Dick Durbin and Republican Senator Orrin Hatch. And then Hatch, in 2012, had to disown the bill because he was facing a right-wing challenger in the primary race. And that, of course, came with the rise of the Tea Party. And what do you think has happened culturally to explain that phenomenon and the current iteration of it we are seeing with Bannonism and Trumpism?
Yeah, I think that there has been this movement toward the politics of resentment. And it was possible for, I think, Republicans to keep a lid on it for a certain period of time. But certainly, by Obama's second term, that was an increasingly difficult undertaking. I also think that it's not coincidental that Donald Trump's political fortunes were based on his ability to paint Barack Obama not only as an illegitimate president, not only as a terrible president, but someone who was, in effect, an immigrant who was not supposed to have been here. I think people didn't see this coming. We look and see how even Marco Rubio was kind of caught in the crosshairs of thinking that it was possible for there to be some sort of consensus on immigration reform, and then having to denounce his own ideas on the subject. So I think that's a good part of what we've been seeing. And then the dynamics of deindustrialization and, you know, what we once called outsourcing and all these other things, which we've been talking about for 20 years, now have been very succinctly and very specifically tied to our relationship to immigration. And I think that was what Trumpism heralded. He did that more effectively, I think, than anyone else in 2016.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
What do you think about how the Democratic Party is coming to terms with some of these problems? Hillary Clinton has a book coming out in which she will soon see what she makes of her defeat at the hands of Donald Trump, which many of us did not think was possible. She didn't ever, for her campaign, find a way to appeal to working-class voters, black or white. And then she made her basket of deplorables comment near the end of the campaign, which to many seemed symptomatic of what was wrong with the Democratic Party.
It's kind of interesting that Hillary Clinton was most significantly damaged by something she said that was basically true. When she talked about the basket of deplorables, one, she didn't say that was everyone voting for Trump, but she did say that there were a kind of significant number of people who harbored these really deplorable ideas. And then when we looked at polling, we saw that very many of them did have racist ideas, and they did have very xenophobic ideas about people who come here from abroad. I think after the election, there was the poll that showed that I think it was somewhere around a quarter of the Republican electorate thought that black people were less intelligent or something. And so those were things that were really troubling. And
yes.
They should have been. But, of course, I think in politics there's, you know, a kind of realization, you should have the ability to determine when you should say something and when you should not, irrespective of whether or not it's true. One of the things I think and have consistently thought was a factor in this was simply the length of time that she had been in public life.
Yes.
That there were so many points that you could go back to, and you could dredge up things from when she was first lady in Arkansas. You could dredge up things from her legal career before that, and then from the Clinton White House, and then in the Senate, and then as Secretary of State. And we don't typically elect people with, you know, really, really long histories in public life like that for a reason.
How do you think the Democrats are going about dealing with the Trump presidency?
It seems, that there's still a great deal of friction, strikingly so, between, I guess, the left wing of the party and, I guess, what you'd say is the more centrist wing. But the people who were enamored of Bernie Sanders still remain deeply skeptical of the establishment. We saw some of this with Kamala Harris just within the past few weeks. There doesn't seem to be any kind of detente between those two elements of the party.
Parties die. Historically, both the Republican and the Democratic Party are in pretty parlous straits at the moment. Do you think that there's a possibility for a third-party movement, that which has always been a very difficult thing to bring about?
So I think we're in a really serious bind. You know, there could very well be a third-party movement, but then you run into the difficulties of the Electoral College. And if we kind of go all the way back, it's 1948, when you had a challenge on the Progressive Party on the left and the Dixiecrats on the right, and neither of them really had a chance of actually winning the election. The Dixiecrats were explicit that they hoped to simply deny an Electoral College majority to either candidate, and they would then be able to, you know, broker what they wanted on the platforms of whoever won in exchange for, you know, a deal, essentially a repeat of the Hayes-Tilden Compromise of 1876. And so that was the kind of – and that didn't work. But the most wildly idealistic idea of third-party candidacies has always wound up being either deny or heavily influence one of the major two parties. That said, I think demographically there's some interesting things in the United States that – we are seeing a population, a society that is becoming more brown, that it will at some point in the not too distant future be a majority minority society.
Which is, of course, one of the precipitating factors for this terrible moment we're in right now.
That's right.
On Wednesday, Trump did one of his head-spinning reversals. After Sessions' announcement, he tweeted, "Congress now has 6 months to legalize DACA, something the Obama administration was unable to do. If they can't, I will revisit this issue."
I don't know how that would happen. I think the Republican Party is in a heck of a tight spot with this. When we think about, you know, the fate of Eric Cantor and people who are, you know, there's real reason for people in the Republican Party to fear this populist insurrection that Trump became the head of, you know, kind of was in existence even before Trump, kind of gets Trumpism prior to Trump. And on the other hand, there are the tremendous consequences of not acting. So I don't know exactly how that will play itself out. But then I also think with Donald Trump saying he would revisit it, it kind of makes you wonder, like, you know, what exactly was the motivation for doing any of this if you intend to revisit it in 6 months if it's not addressed through Congress.
What does reasonable immigration reform look like? You mentioned at the beginning of the program, people get confused between illegal and legal immigration. Obama's own record is mixed. During his administration,
yeah,
you know, more illegal immigrants were deported than under any other president before him.
One of the things that I would hope to see, I think, in Obama's memoirs would be some further explication of his thinking on immigration, because early on, it seemed that he was aggressively enforcing deportation in order to kind of come down on the far end as a bargaining chip to maybe come move back to the center with Republicans. And we saw that same thing with him taking the position on offshore drilling that he thought would get him a deal with Republicans on climate change, and is one of a number of instances where I think he overestimated his ability to strike a deal with the Republican Party. But certainly, I think that a kind of reasonable policy that allows people who have been here to find a route to legalization of their status, whatever that looks like, I think would be a beginning, would be a reasonable beginning for this, especially when we're looking at a point now where we aren't inundated at the border with the kind of crisis that we saw 2 years ago.
We've almost forgotten the phrase, a pathway to citizenship.
Right. But I think there's a kind of argument that can be presented to this where a lot of the populist anger has been directed at the idea that people who are undocumented are driving down wages. And there's an analogy, I think there's a comparison of this that I found in African American history, which is that very often, you know, long ago in the middle and beginning of the 20th century, you saw very much a similar arguments being made about African-American workers who were by and large ununionized and were being used as labor to drive down, you know, the wages of white workers. At least that's what the argument was. And it took organized labor decades to realize that the solution to this was actually inviting more people into the fold of organized labor rather than excluding. And so that might be, you know, the kind of analogy that's applicable here, that if you're saying that there's this issue with people, you really believe, I think economists have some disagreement about this, but if you really believe that this is your main concern about driving down wages, then it's actually an argument for giving people a path to legal status.
But you have to convince members of the working class who are so terrified about losing their own livelihoods that this is not going to hurt them. And that's,
right.
You know, nobody's figured out how to do that yet.
Yeah, that's the hard sell.
Thank you so much, Jelani.
Thank you.
Jelani Cobb is a staff writer, a professor of journalism at Columbia University, and the author of The Substance of Hope, Barack Obama and the Paradox of Progress. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review The Political Scene on iTunes. This podcast is produced by Jill Dubuff for newyorker.com with help from Hannah Wilentz. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.